Welcome to the 5 W's podcast. What works for who, in what context, and why. The podcast is a form of knowledge exchange for my current doctoral studies at Leeds Beckett University, exploring a biopsychosocial approach to athlete development. The conversation seeks to gain perspective from a wide range of practitioners, namely academia, athletes, and coaches. I hope you enjoy the show. As the great Aristotle once said, in the case of all things which have several parts and in which the totality is not, as it were, a mere heap, but the whole is something beside the parts, which is often paraphrased to, the whole is greater than the sum of parts. That is what we're discussing today. Culture, values, environment, are just some of the numerous terms you'll hear repeated verbatim when listening to athlete and coach interviews. But what does that actually mean? What does it look like? How can you develop successful social processes within the team environment? How can you drive psychosocial components of coaching to influence physical performance? Dr. Sean Figgins, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for inviting me.
Not a problem. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. So I know you're in demand with your research and your lecturing. But before we get into the main topic, would you be so kind as to give the listeners a little bit about yourself, background, current role, any publications that you want to highlight?
Yeah, I guess like most people, I'm a bit of a failed sportsman. My background in terms of sport, mainly in football and cricket, nothing really to speak of by amateur level, I guess. But I really enjoy those, still compete in both of those. And from a more kind of professional background, my main role is as a lecturer and I teach and research. I'm pretty lucky in this way in that my teaching is focused pretty much solely on social psychology, broadly, but also mainly applied to sport and sometimes exercise contexts. So teach around the areas of group dynamics at both undergrad and master's level. And in terms of research, well, I look at group dynamics broadly, but my specific focuses have been on leadership, and in particular how leaders inspire followers and also how they develop trust. Also, I've looked at and active in the area of understanding how talented, problematic players impact in groups and how to work best with them. And finally, I'm interested in the area of social identity and how that applies in sport and exercise groups. So I've got a couple of projects on the go in relation to that, and also supervised a PhD student who's looking at that exercise. And in terms of kind of publications, published a range of articles, mainly at the moment in time on leadership and that area of talented, problematic players. We've got one or two out as well.
Thanks for that. That gives a kind of a broad scope of what we're going to talk about today. I, like probably many listening to the podcast, work in a team sport environment. So that knowledge and that research that you've done, I think, is going to be a valuable message or insight today. Because when you listen to sport or you hear athletes and coaches give interviews, they often talk about culture or values or team ethic to enhance that individual or group performance. And given the current circumstances we're in, COVID-19, social distancing, you know, for example, the rugby team I'm currently involved in has two or more bubbles operating. Obviously, I can't interact with all of those bubbles face-to-face, and I'm sure that's the case kind of nationwide, you know, not just rugby, every other sport going. So those kind of group psychology, those social identity processes, I think would be kind of really good to unpack and see how we can use them to drive, you know, performance in these challenging times. Seeing as you're an academic, I will pay homage to the classic BBC University Challenge, your starter for 10. So what theories, concept frameworks exist that explore the social processes or the group psychology within a sporting context?
So there are a fair few, and there are probably a few kind of ones that have been dominant in the sport and exercise psychology literature specifically. And I guess everyone would have heard of these, so I'm sure for yourself in your education you will have done as well, but people listening would have heard of like cohesion and also leadership, and the main focus of those group dynamics ones probably has been those. But what we've seen more recently is research has started to explore other areas, such as the work of Desmond McEwen and Mark Beauchamp and others. I'll probably forget loads of people in this, so I apologise if I offend anyone. But they've done a lot of work on teamwork. And there's also been a lot of work, as we've kind of touched upon recently, on social identity and group identity in sport and exercise contexts. And also there's been some, especially from an applied perspective, but they're starting to do some initial research in sport now on the area of psychological safety. Although that one in particular, that, like I said, it's only just been started to explore in sport, but it's been explored more in an organisational context, because a lot of these theories have kind of been developed in other contexts and then kind of borrowed and adopted by sport as well. But those are probably the key ones.
So that's probably the first one that I'd like to explore with you. It's something that I'm trying to develop with my own practice, and it's a term that I've stolen from a guy called Dan Abrahams. Nicked it from Twitter on his feed. He talks about it. Is creating a PIE, a psychologically informed environment. Because I think when you're dealing with coaches and even with athletes, when the word psychology comes up, it's automatically a barrier, whether that's because people don't fully understand the subject, they're not quite grasping what it is, they're going to rely on people like yourself to deal with that side of it. What would be your recommendations to create and implement a PIE or create some form of psychological safety when they're engaging with athletes?
I think you bring up an interesting point there about the barrier of psychology. And it's kind of made me reflect when you're saying that on why that is. And I guess part of that might just be environmentally, culturally, and I guess this goes across the world, we're not very good at perhaps discussing things related to our own mental states. And I wonder whether that's a bit of that as well. Whereas, I don't know, obviously I'm not a practitioner as such, but you're probably better informed in this area than me. I don't know whether coaches are more comfortable with like kind of the physical side of things, so working with S&C coaches, physiologists, biomechanists, because it is more physical related. I don't know whether that's the case. You're probably in a better space to talk about that than me. But yeah, I guess that might be one of the key things. So I wonder whether that affects it in some way. But in terms of how you go about creating a psychologically informed environment, I think I've seen that on Twitter as well. I'm not sure whether it's in the literature as such, but it's a nice term. I guess the key thing is understanding what you want to initially look at. So what is it you're trying to do? And from a psychological safety perspective, I think that is an interesting term as well. And my understanding of what it means is that it's related to somebody feeling confident that you can kind of take risks. And that might be from a performance perspective, or it might be from a well-being perspective, asking for help. Taking responsibility for errors and kind of being vulnerable without fear of like a negative reaction from others in the group, be that your peers or your coach. I think the interesting thing about psychological safety is it is a kind of a consequence of other factors within the environment. So things like the culture and the identity. So I think if I was to sort of say, where would my recommendations be, and perhaps this is my biases of what I'm interested in and where I research, but I think there's quite a lot of evidence to kind of support this. I would focus on, if you want to create a psychologically safe environment, one area I think that most people can have a look at is the identity of the group. What I mean by that is, well, what makes the group special? What makes the group different? What are the norms and what are the values that kind of drive everything that the group does? So the behaviour within that group. There's plenty of research that kind of shows that teams with a really strong identity, and when I say that, basically members feel strongly attached to the group, so they feel that they belong, they feel quite comfortable in that that environment. The research shows that they'll perform better and have better well-being as well, and are more motivated. But more recently, there's been some initial work that's shown that, or suggests that actually group identity impacts on psychological safety. So that's some research done by Katrine Franson, Desmond McEwen, and Mustafa Sarkar. So they suggest that actually the performance and well-being consequences that happen as a result of stronger identification are mediated by psychological safety. So what I mean by that is, as group identification increases, perceptions of psychological safety in a group also increase, which leads to those better performance and well-being outcomes. So I guess that's why I would start at group identity. I think I've given you a really long-winded answer. Yeah, that's where I would start.
We've used the words values, culture, environment a couple of times already in the conversation, and rightly or wrongly, the words that you will hear in sporting clubs throughout the land. Do those words or focuses influence the social psychology, or does the psychology of the group form the values, culture, and environment?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I guess the answer is it's probably a little bit of both. Not necessarily the words values themselves and culture themselves, but the values and norms of a group will influence the psychology of the group, so the way people think, the way they perhaps feel, and also the way they behave. But we can't ignore the fact that people within the group and the group itself will also impact on their values and the norms, because, you know, people bring their own characteristics, their own traits to a group, and often, you know, groups aren't always that stable, especially at the more elite end, perhaps less at the participation end, but at the more elite end, I'd imagine there's quite a high turnover of individuals within a group. So it might be quite malleable and changeable, the kind of the values and the culture there.
Talking about that kind of process, and do you set the values first and then the players buy into that, or do the kind of what the players are bringing kind of form your opinion? Most coaches will have a conceptual model of how they want to play the sport. It might be a shared mental model, communal language, maybe their coaching philosophy. If I'm a coach and I'm looking to build a social identity, a culture, a team value, whichever term you want to use, can I be as formal as applying a model or a framework, or is the process more organic?
I think that's a really interesting question. And actually, I think the short answer is yes, there is a framework that you can use to develop identity. And it will be slightly organic, and we can perhaps talk about that as we go along. But there have been a couple of models that have been developed to help apply some of that theory to practice. It's called the 5 R's approach, and it was initially developed in organisational context by Alex Haslam, who's a really key researcher in social psychology, and his colleagues. But more recently, it's been applied in sport. So again, there's a lot of R's, but there's the 5 R's framework by Katrine Branson and colleagues, including Alex Haslam. And also one of her PhD students, I think his name's Niels Mertens, apologies if that's wrong. But they've looked at that. And also more simplified model by Slater and Barker. So there's plenty of literature if people want to look at that. But to boil that process down, and I'll talk to the model that Slater and Barker talked about, essentially there are three stages. There's a bit of a reflection stage, a representing stage, and a realizing stage. And what happens in the reflecting stage, what coach or other people, other formal leaders in the group, other staff, and the group themselves can do is listen and observe the group to try and understand, well, what are the identities that matter to individuals within an organization? The representing stage is about ensuring that there are actions that actually champion that collective identity. And the third phase, realizing, is about embedding in reality that identity. So it isn't something that's just pretty words and kind of like you see these quotes and these phrases on the wall. It's actually about making that identity real and something that people live up to. So just to give a little bit more kind of depth on that, what can happen in the kind of the reflecting stage, and there's no, I guess, hard and fast way to do this, and coaches could adapt this or teams could adapt this whichever way they want. But the one thing you can do is go through what's called kind of identity mapping, where you get members of the group to really think about, well, what does it mean to me to be a part of this group? What are the goals and the values that I identify with within this group that make us kind of special? After you've done that, so you'll have, I don't know how many people are in your group, let's say you've got a squad of 20 and 10 staff, you might have 30 of these kind of maps or words or values on a page. And the next stage is called representing. And what happens here is typically, you know, either a practitioner, perhaps a psychologist, or the coach, if they're leading this themselves, or somebody else, will take kind of all those away and collate similar values. So what you'll end up with is a list of kind of important values, which leads to your kind of your representing phase. And what that can involve is typically a smaller group of people, because trying to get like 30 people to agree on, you know, a set of core values could probably be really difficult. So for instance, in the Slater and Barker research, they talk about some work they did with an elite kind of Paralympic team. And they involved what was called a senior leadership team. So it involved some players, some staff. I think it was mainly players in this instance. What they got them to do is they gave them all these values. And in that representing phase, they got them into the senior leadership team and asked them to decide upon, based upon those four or five real key values that make up the group's identity. So that could be anything. It could be things related to support or related to togetherness. It could be related to bravery. So they come up with those, and then what they might do is then present these back to the group and get them discussed as a whole group so that everyone's kind of input in. And I guess that's kind of the important bit within that, is that the group themselves are involved in that process so that it doesn't become kind of imposed upon. Because if you're trying to get a group to buy into a group identity and they aren't part of that process, and it's just the omnipotent coach at the top kind of going, this is what our values are, this is how we are going to be, that could come a cropper. So yeah, at the end of that kind of representing stage, you kind of come up with typically 4 to 5 values. And then after that, I guess focus becomes on, well, we've got these 4 to 5 values, that's really nice, we've got these 4 to 5 kind of words or phrases which are not what we're about. And I guess the key thing is, how do we go about making that a reality? And again, there's some really nice things that you can do. So one of them can be, as a group, again, coming up with like kind of 4 to 5 behaviors that really represent what those values are in action. So they're things that you can see and observe in everyday training, interactions and competition that really demonstrate what the core values are about. And then finally, you've got the kind of realizing stage, which is all about tying all these values together in kind of like a shared vision of where the group wants to go, what they want to achieve, where they want to be. And ideally, this is in line with, well, not ideally, it should be in line with the values, and it should be something really aspirational that the group really strives to be. I guess the key thing within all of that is that's all good, but it needs to be unique to the group. So that's why you have to go through this process of really understanding what the group's about to develop this unique identity that makes the group feel special to be a part of. Because we've all been part of groups, and I know yourself, we were talking in your rugby rugby man. I know my cricket team that I play for. Everyone always thinks that their group is, well, it, especially in some way, you're like, oh, I wouldn't want to play for that other team. There's nothing like here. Our social side is so much better than theirs, or I don't really like that group. And a lot of that probably is bound up in some of these processes, because you can't really steal from other groups, because every group's got like a unique history, traditions and makeup. So I guess I've done that in a long-winded way, but that's kind of like the things that you can go through.
No, thank you for expanding upon that model, you know, not just us, the 3 hours, trying to give a clear kind of picture of how that process might work. If coaches and athletes are listening to this and think, right, I want to implement such a model and I'm going to use those 3 hours, when you're kind of trying to read if it's going all right or if it's been successful, is social identity or group psychology something we can measure? Can it be objective? Or is it, as you've said, is it one of those great intangibles? You just have a feel. You walk into that changing room and you know there's a little buzz, there's an aura, there's a little something there, isn't there? Or can you see, actually, yeah, we've decided resilience is going to be one of our key values. Is that something you can measure, or is it just an interpretation?
It's a bit, as with any kind of, especially within psychology, any kind of variable, you can suggest it's a bit more difficult to answer that question, but we can measure perceptions of identification, definitely. So there are questionnaires that people can use to assess the effectiveness of that. There are a host of different ones. But if you wanted to measure the effectiveness of it, you could purely and simply go like at time point A, so before we do this intervention, let's measure this, let's see whether this intervention will improve that, and you can take it again at multiple time points after the intervention to see how effective that's been. So, you know, there's plenty of research that shows that group identification and things like identity leadership improve as a result of these workshops. And in sport, there's some growing evidence to suggest this happens. But it's very much in its early stages, despite that promising evidence. And I guess in terms of observing it, yeah, I guess that's where that key part in that representing phase of the 3 hours comes up, in that if you've got that list of kind of key behaviours that address those values that people should be showing, then if you go into that environment, you should be able to see people showing those behaviours which are in line with those values. So it should be something that you can observe. But yeah, that's what I see. I guess you might see if you went in is, are those, because we see it in, for instance, a lot of the documentaries we can see now, the Amazon Prime documentaries on New Zealand, Man City, Tottenham Hotspurs. We saw these like lovely things they've got written on the wall. So if you go into an environment, you see that, I guess the proof will be, well, what are they doing when they're in the gym with the S&C coach? What are they doing when they're out on the training pitch? What are they doing when they're interacting with themselves, so their teammates, and you know, even the staff in the canteen, for instance? If people are actually showing those behaviours, then we can really see, well, actually, there is a strong identity here. So it's taking it from that abstract concept of these are the values to that nitty-gritty kind of these are the key behaviours and we should be seeing those. And I guess you can, if you really want to measure it, there are ways you can actually go, well, let's have a look at this, let's reflect on what we're doing, how well are we showing these behaviours?
I think that's a really interesting point, because a lot of teams will probably put out these words, write things on the wall, you know, have a certain mantra, possibly, but actually, are they living that experience? Are they demonstrating that in actions and behaviours? And I think sometimes I prefer those words, actions and behaviours, because they're the lived experience, they're the visceral experience of a word on a wall, aren't they? What I want to try and kind of unpack now is how that social identity maybe changes throughout a season. So, for example, at the start of the season, when teams, individuals are maybe setting goals, you know, we want to win promotion this year, we want to win so many games, we want to win a cup. How does that affect social identity? And as you've kind of brushed upon before as well, what happens when new players come into that environment? How is that impacting what we've created as a social identity?
I guess the key thing, and this is the key thing with identity, is that that vision kind of drives everything you do. So if that vision of what you're trying to work towards is really aspirational, then your goals need to kind of align with that, be that short, medium, long-term, you know, more process out or outcome goals. They all need to align with that, to help you live that out. And I guess, again, they might be quite mutually reinforcing. So your goals might influence your identity, and your identity might influence your goals, depending upon what stage you're at when you're trying to develop identity. So, for instance, if you're lucky enough to be with a completely new team, you're setting up a new team, you know, you're David Beckham and you're setting up into Miami Football Club, then you're at a really nice stage in that you can come up with your identity and your vision, and then you can set your goals based upon that. Whereas if the group's already well established, and there's a real history and past achievements, so for instance Manchester United and Liverpool, then clearly you know you're going to have some quite high goals that you set. So I guess the key thing is making sure that those goals are aligned with the identity of the group. And I guess this is where actually having multiple values could be really important, depending upon how the team is, in air quotes, performing at a given moment. There's been some work looking at what's called identity content, so that relates to the values of the group. And I guess the key thing is that when you're performing really well, obviously having kind of more performance-based or outcome-based goals is great. But the question then becomes, well, what if the team isn't performing well and kind of your identity is all about winning and performing really well and everything's based around outcome? What then happens? Whereas if you've got perhaps a more like kind of varied group identity, so perhaps there's things that revolve around other aspects. So it could be relationships, it could be friendships, it could be support. Then perhaps at points during the season, your goals can kind of change slightly, so that you're not just losing confidence and esteem because, well, actually, you're not performing well. We're not living up to our identity because it's all about that. You can actually focus on, well, are we showing each other support? So can our goal for the next couple of weeks be, we're not performing very well, let's make sure that we're not getting on each other's backs? Because, again, you can kind of observe and perhaps even measure that in some way. And then from a performance-related focus, I guess it might depend on the kind of rigidity of your performance related values. So if you've got values about performance and kind of one of your values is related to being quite brave or innovative, then that leaves more scope for you to kind of evaluate those in broader range of ways, not just the kind of binary outcomes of win versus loss. It might be that if you're being brave, let's say in football, you want to be braver on the ball, you want your team to play really innovative, forward-thinking football. There are different ways you can measure that. It could be forward passes, it could be line-breaking passes, chances created, all those kind of different metrics that we can actually observe and measure, which shows actually we are working towards our values and our goals. Perhaps we might not be winning, but we are making progress. And in terms of turnover of play, that's a really interesting one, because I guess the values of the group could almost, and I don't know whether this goes on at the elite level, I'm sure in some way they talk about how characters are set, but those values could drive your recruitment in some way, couldn't they? But, you know, you could get in players that represent those values, and it could be the way that the style of play. So if one of yours is about bravery, then you can get in a player that really epitomises that on the pitch, for instance. But also I think it's important that this is within this process of values, and we might talk about this later, within this process of developing our identity, is given that you are going to have a turnover of players, it's probably not something that is necessarily 100% concrete and set in stone and doesn't change. Because if you're having a turnover of players, the individual makeup within that group is likely to change, isn't it? So you might need to reassess it over several time points or every half season or every season to see how it's going. So, for instance, in the paper that I mentioned by Slater and Barker, or did Barker and Slater? I'm not sure. One of them will probably call me for this. But their intervention was over 2 years, and they went through that process both years because of a change in the personnel as well.
That led me on to my next question. I was going to try and unpack a time frame, because we've explored personnel, athletes and players kind of turnover. But what happens if a new coach comes in? You often hear within sport the new manager bounce, or the manager's lost the changing room. Is there a time frame? You know, arguably some teams, the All Blacks, might have had their value system for 5-10 years. Some teams are just obviously setting up. Where's a key time point to reflect upon that, to say, is this working? Is it not working? Is it right for our group? Is it full season? You obviously need time for things to grow and mould, but you don't want to leave it too long before thinking, actually, we need to change this because it's not really what this group's about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. So I guess it really depends upon a range of things, the level of your group, how much time you've got together. But research has kind of shown or suggests that it can depend on a range of things, but you can get some quite positive effects quite early on. So some of the work by Niels Mertens, I can't remember the exact time point, but it was over a few months, and they showed some quite positive consequences of creating that identity and developing leadership within groups. We had a master's student this year who looked at it within esports teams and did it over a very short, constrained period of time, and noted that the intervention appeared to have impacts positively on resilience over a 4 to 6 week period. Now, the key thing, I guess, is making sure that within... So I think the final R in the five R's, everyone loves an acronym, is about reporting. So it's about monitoring it. And I guess that's the other key thing, is that you're actually going and reflecting upon what those values are. So I guess the key thing is continually monitoring it at various stages. So I think going back to that Slater and Barclay with Paralympic team, I think the senior leadership team themselves took it upon themselves as a group to regularly reflect on those. I can't remember whether it was weekly, but it was fairly regularly to look at those set of 4 or 5 behaviours that I had for each value, to go, well, let's sit down, let's rate these. So no, you're like, they're quite arbitrary, like 1 to 5 like a scale, 5 being 100% we're doing these, and 1 not very well. Kind of going, well, how are we doing these? Okay, we're 5 on this, so obviously that doesn't need that much looking at, but we're not so good on this one, so we need to kind of make sure that we are trying to show this. How can we do this? What's the kind of activities that can we get involved in, or can we set up to try and develop the behaviours associated with that value? So again, it's a bit of a journey, and I guess it's a never ending kind of journey in a way, because it might fluctuate quite a lot. It's a really interesting thing going on about the first point you made about the coach themselves and new coaches coming in. Because I think there's some really good examples where coaches come in and they clearly buy into what the group's about. And an obvious one, and this may be just because they are successful and it might not be anything to do with it, is Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool. Liverpool have a really kind of strong identity, and he really seems to understand not only the identity of Liverpool Football Club, but also the city associated with Liverpool as well. So even when he talks about kind of like political issues, he seems to be in line with the city and what they kind of have an ideal in relation to politics as well. So I guess my key takeaway there would be that leaders really need to consider the group when they're coming into a group. They need to understand what that group is about, not just from a performance perspective, but also from a group psychology perspective. So trying to understand what what are the values of a group, and making sure in some way that they're trying to align themselves with that. Because you're more likely, based upon the kind of evidence we've got, to be successful if you are prototypical of those values. So if you really role model what the group is about, I think if you come in and kind of try and change too much, or perhaps try and completely change the identity of the group, it could be more difficult. So some of the research that, you know, I've looked at in terms of how leaders inspire people, when you talk to people like, well, why was it so inspiring coming from that person? A lot of what I talk about is kind of, well, I really trusted them. So I guess, and one of the key things that they talked about there was that, well, they really represented what the group was about. So they really role modeled what was important for the group. And that had a real key impact on why they found them inspirational, because they trusted them.
How could a new coach or a young coach develop that trust quickly? Because if you come into a new environment, you're a new coach or a young coach that's maybe been promoted from assistant to head, is there certain things that you can do to establish that trust and establish a position of leadership?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So in terms of what we found in that study, we kind of put up the based upon people's experiences, a kind of theory, and there were three key elements to developing trust. One of them was basically how competent you are. So if you're a really good coach, you know, if you're brilliant and you get results, and you know, you've got a CV that says I've won X, Y, and Z, then you're onto a bit of a winner initially anyway, because you've got that behind you. So people are going to buy into you and trust you from at least from a performance perspective. But the interesting thing with that was a lot of the people that didn't find their kind of coaches inspiring when we spoke to them was that they were saying, well, initially, yeah, he's really good. But then when I got to know him, I didn't like him. I just didn't trust him because they didn't treat me very well, or they didn't treat someone else very well. So that, I guess if I was to say something to young coaches based upon that, it is trying to understand what the group is about and trying to act in line with those behaviours. Being really aware of what you are kind of saying to people. So for instance, you know, if you're speaking to people and selling them kind of a dream of, or promises that you're going to play, you know, I'm going to give you minutes, and then you're not backing that up with your actions, then people are going to see through you and you're going to lose trust fairly quickly. So I think a key thing is always being aware of what you've said to people and backing that up with your actions. And also being aware of how you're treating everyone, because not only do individuals trust you based upon how you treat them, but they're likely to trust you based upon how you're treating other people as well. So yeah, it's all those little things like getting to know people and kind of showing interest in them outside of sport as well. This is based upon some of the, we for the study, we interviewed some kind of really high profile elite level athletes, and again, that kind of human element came through. They were like, well, it wasn't necessarily that my coach helped change my technique or really improved me. It was that they showed an interest in me outside of sport. It wasn't just, oh, you're here to perform. It was, well, actually, they asked me about my family, or one person said, oh, my coach, my car broke down, and they came, picked me up and took me to the garage, that kind of thing. And that was really important for them as well. So I guess getting to know people is really, really important. And from what we talked about today, like I've said a couple of times in answer to this question, trying to understand what the values of the group are. And that might be really easy, because teams might have a really clear set of values, so they might be everywhere, all over all the walls, and you can kind of try and align with those. Or it might be a process of perhaps going through kind of like the reflect, the represent and realise process, and making those more clear to everyone, because that way you're not trying to change it necessarily, but you're trying to understand it and show that you're interested in that, and then you can align your behaviour and try and come up with activities during practice that enable people to live out those values as well.
When we talk about those values and reinforcing them on a consistent basis, is it as simple as a 1 minute discussion about it, or a quick recap of that behaviour there that lives up to our values? The reason I ask that is I'm guessing most teams will seek to build this type of process, culture, values, environment, generally during and often a pre-season where they've got time to sit down and take those 30 minutes, hour and a half sessions to say, right, let's come up, let's mind map what we want to be as a team. When you're in season, that's a lot more difficult. You know, you're dedicating time to technical, tactical issues, conditioning, et cetera, et cetera. So when you are looking to consistently and continually look at and explore those values, can it just be a 1 minute conversation, or does this have to be a more formal process in terms of let's really evaluate, let's reflect upon what we've talked about previously and maybe score it and give real examples of how we can live up to that?
It's an interesting one. I guess it depends, like you said, it depends on the time you've got, how much time have you got your players, how much time you've got access to them. If you're in a semi-professional environment, for instance, whereby we, you know, you've only got to look at semi-professional environments, particularly within, sorry, gone about again, but football, where teams change managers like that in an instant, I guess your focus is purely going to be on performance, and it could be quite difficult to monitor those there. I guess the key thing is making sure that there is some thought process about how you are going to monitor these and how that's going to look. And it might be that, for instance, you do it every week, or it might be that you have it every month or every other month. And how you go about that, it might be that you dedicate a certain period of time to it and it has to be really strict and rigid in that way. But if you haven't got much time, well, you could get people say you've got four values and you've got four behaviours for each. You could, for each value, go, well, like, what we're going to do is each week we're going to get you to jot down or with, out of five where you rate this value. And then I guess at the end of the month, you could focus on the one that you're perhaps not living up to as well. How can we improve that? Or you could just say, well, what these ones we are doing well, what are we doing so well that shows these? I guess there's no hard and fast rules for it. Ideally, you'd like to be continuously, constantly monitoring these, but we know in practice that's probably not. You're probably not able to do it. I know that in the work that Slater and Barker did, the senior leadership team were really keen to do this and monitor it quite regularly. So they used a bit of a combination of the self-report measure and then discussed how and why they can improve on certain aspects. I guess you could also have somebody, a staff member, that perhaps focuses on this and perhaps observes this in practice and observes people interacting, and they could do that over a certain period of time. It could be like, you go, right, for this hour this week, can you watch training and interactions and kind of see, rate how you think we're delivering these and what people are doing to show these values. I think the key thing is, as with any intervention, I suppose it's the same in the S&C world as well, or in the coaching world, if we don't monitor and measure and reflect upon things, then they're probably not going to improve and not going to have the impact. And if you just go, for instance, in the identity, if you're trying to build identity and connection within a group, you know, the research in the applied literature would suggest that actually a kind of a one-off, we've cracked this now, this is our identity. Without that monitoring and that purposeful kind of evaluation and adjustment, it might not have that impact that you want it to have. And again, another thing that might come down to, and you touched upon it at the beginning, is how much does the person who's in charge, generally the manager or the coach, how much do they believe in that? Some might believe in it more than others. And I suppose if they don't believe in it, they're not gonna dedicate the time to that. So getting that buy-in to do it is really going to be important, I imagine, for practitioners. It'd be interesting, I guess, for you and for listeners to speak to someone that has gone through this process and kind of reflect on their experiences of it.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to be in a number of environments that have kind of gone through that, and reflecting myself of what I consider to be a really good environment versus what I consider to be an unhelpful environment. So yeah, it's interesting how you've broken down the stages and kind of talked about that monitoring or that evaluation aspect. This question might be difficult or might be an existential question. So you've set this value system up. You've got three or four key values that the players, the athletes have come up with themselves. You've tied them together in umbrella terms, and it's a lived experience for us. Day by day, session by session, there is some form of reflection upon those values. However, you have one player that maybe isn't living up to those values. Not necessarily they're not buying into them, but people probably know one person within their environment that might be the maverick. And sometimes you hear about it, coaches can't deal with maverick players, can they? You know, they might be the best player on the team, but they're so good at the sport, they can hit wonderful shots or pull players out of their back pocket. If someone isn't engaging or is not living up to that value system, how can you deal with them? Because I think Rio Ferdinand, Man United, was the FIFO, fit in or fuck off, which might seem very harsh, but should you try and bring people in to that environment and kind of give them that chance? Or are you going to be hard line and say, this is our value system, there's the line. If you're not willing to jump over that line, off you go.
It's a really interesting question. It's one I've been kind of reflecting on because we've done some research in this, right? Actively doing some research, understanding more from a, as you mentioned there, those really talented kind of players and those ones that cause problems. And there are plenty of probably high-profile examples. I won't mention them. I'm sure everyone can kind of think of some high-profile examples of those players. And I guess there's kind of two perspectives to take on. Often that kind of, as you said, put it, fit in, or I won't say what you said, or go away. go away kind of perspective, you're not fitting in, so let's get rid of them. But sometimes I think we can fail to look at the perspective of that individual. So in our kind of research, we've kind of seen, well, actually, if you look at a behaviour, so let's say you've got a team meeting and a player criticises the tactics. If that player is someone who typically doesn't cause problems or really aligns with the group values, their viewpoint might be seen as they're trying to help the group. Whereas if you've got one of those players that's really talented, but they do cause problems, so that, you know, they don't live up to those values like they say quite often, then they do the same thing. Their opinion might be seen as they are being negative, they're being critical, they're not trying to help the group, they're just trying to undermine the coach. So it's a really interesting one. And I think the point about the values, and this is something that hasn't been explored yet, but probably needs to be explored, is how, are there any negative sides to them? So can you have a set of values that are so strict and entrenched but actually they don't allow for perhaps kind of some flexibility, some individuality, whereby we allow for diverse opinions and they allow people to be individual as well. I'm going back to the point of what you do with them, how do you work with them. Actually, it's really interesting. Speaking to sports psychologists about this part of the research, they kind of go, well, I'm not really sure. I haven't really cracked it yet. They'll talk about things they've tried, but they're like, it's actually really difficult because there's just nothing out there that to kind of guide this process. But often they're like, well, it does, depending on how good they are, there are kind of two ways to go about it. Either they get dinged out because, well, actually they don't offer anything from a performance perspective, or the coach or whoever just kind of lets them get away with it because they're just so good that we can't do without them. We need them, otherwise we're not going to win. And which puts puts your kind of, especially if you've placed a lot of importance on your values, it kind of puts that in a place of real jeopardy. And if you haven't got players that can replace that really talented but problematic player, then people are going to be like, well, what's the point in this? Because, you know, we're getting told that this is really important, but this person here, they're not living up to that. So why are we doing it? Just some kind of suggestions that we've seen. If you kind of get the player in question kind of involved in the process, let's say you have a senior leadership team, depending upon who the individual is, you might say, well, actually, we'll get them involved in that so that they can feel really important in that process and feel really valued. Then they might be more inclined to live up to those values. Trying to get them on side in some way might be important. But other than that, the answer is at the minute I'm not quite sure, and it's a really interesting question. And I think it poses other questions as well, like I said, about, well, are there any downsides to being highly identified? There probably are. It could be that you create this environment whereby you've got such a strong group that it's difficult for newcomers to come into. It's difficult for anyone that perhaps doesn't quite necessarily fit that mould to really feel what they fit in. So it could potentially have some negative outcomes as well. But I guess that's where that kind of monitoring comes in. But yeah, it's a really interesting question. I'm not sure whether I've answered it. But
no, I don't, like you say, I don't think anyone can or anyone has yet answered that question. I think it comes down to the context, doesn't it? Who that player is, who the manager is or the coach is and their relationship. It's difficult to know, isn't it? I just, because you do hear about it, you know, the coach has lost the dressing room. Is that because senior players have allowed that to happen or kind of being on the outside, or that one majestic player that is such a maverick can get away with not living up to those values and everyone else seeing that and thinking, well, why can't I do that? Or why isn't the joining that? Just thought it might be an interesting question. And if anyone has explored that real maverick, because I think in the UK especially, I think on the continent, in Europe, they maybe appreciate that outlier a little bit more. I think in the UK, we are quite rigid. We have a system, you fit our system or you go elsewhere. And you often hear about, you know, elite coaches and managers not picking a certain player, and they don't directly say this, but it is maybe it's because the maverick, they can't fit into a system. They don't quite know how to handle and work with that player. Just a question I thought I'd throw at you just to see if there was an answer.
And it's interesting you said that, if we look at it anecdotally, so Sir Alex Ferguson talks about in his book, or people talk about how, for instance, like, I think there's a famous story of Ryan Giggs was talking about how they all got told they had to dress really smart for an awards do, and there was certain standards, they had to wear a tie or whatever, and Eric Cantona turned up in this really lash outfit. I can't remember what it was, but apparently Ferguson just went, oh, he looks really cool or something. And they were like, well, hang on a minute, you said to us we have to do this. But they didn't seem to bat an eyelid. They didn't seem to bat an eyelid at that differential treatment. And I guess that's an important point is, while all these things are important, at the elite level, whether it's better or worse, success and winning kind of, and I don't think it is necessarily always for better, definitely there are instances where it isn't, kind of seems to trump everything, doesn't it? Like, if you're winning and your coach kind of lets the player do what they want and the team are happy because they're winning, then they're likely to let that slide. And that happened with Sir Alex Ferguson continuously winning. But if things start to go south and you're not winning and you start to lose, then those issues seem to come to a head, that differential treatment. So I guess if you're going to treat people differently, you'd be really good at your job and always win. But yeah, it is a really interesting question, and I think that it'll be interesting to see what the research kind of comes out with in the end in relation to that question of how you deal with that really talented but problematic or maverick player, as you call it.
Bringing the conversation to a close or a summary, could you provide the listeners just three take-home messages or three bits of guidance if they're thinking about setting up a group psychology or an identity for their team? what might be three key messages to help them do that?
So firstly, well, not necessarily in this order, but in the number one, if you're going to go into a pre-existing group and you're interested in the identity and you want to change it, you've got to try to understand the group first. That's where that reflecting process is really important. And kind of aligned with that, if you do want to change an identity, I don't think you can just take another group's identity and plonk it straight into your environment. So there's that really nice book from is it Steve Kerr or called Legacy about the All Blacks? James Kerr on Legacy. And people talk a lot about that, but you know, their identity is bigger than just rugby, isn't it? You know, the whole it's like the nation. So you couldn't just take all their stuff and go, well, I'm going to plonk it into my team. And make sure that the group's involved in that process as well, because if everyone has input, they're more likely to buy into it. The second one, make sure, like we talked about here, monitoring it and evaluating that identity kind of regularly. And that, how that works is completely dependent upon time and whatever, but the more regularly you can do it, probably the better, if you want to create that strong connection in the group. And finally, as with anything, do your preparation. So read around the area. That might not necessarily be the scientific literature, although obviously if you can and you have access to that and understanding of it, do it. So there's plenty of work by Alex Haslam, Katrine Franson, Pete Coffey, Matt Slater, Jamie Barker. There's plenty of others as well. But if you want something that's going to provide you some really practical tips, there is a good book by Matt Slater called Togetherness. And he talks about, in quite simple terms, what identity is and bringing a group together. But it's also got some really nice practical activities that you can do to engage in each of those R's. So it can really help you bring that theory into practice within your own team. So you could take some of those activities and do them with your own group. So that's a really nice book. So those would be my three.
Excellent. I think messages that everyone could take away and use in their context. So thank you so much for providing that answer. And thank you for your time again today.
Thanks for having me.
Hope you enjoyed that discussion and it provided plenty of food for thought, whether you're seeking to implement a group identity values-based system within the context you currently work in, or debating whether to amend or manipulate the culture you presently exist in. For me, two things stand out from that conversation. Number one, as a leader, am I trying to impose my will on the group? Or am I taking the time to understand the needs, politics, and contextual information that exists within it? And secondly, as an athlete or coach, am I really living those behaviours? Am I modelling them for others? Not only individuals within the group, but outsiders looking in. I've had the pleasure of being involved in a number of environments that I perceive or would consider to be excellent. It was superb to be engaged, empowered, and accountable to those standards. I've also had the displeasure of seeing the other side, where words merely are placed on a pedestal for show, and every day was tiresome, tedious, and distressing. Believe me, the two aspects are not that far apart, and it's a fine balancing act getting that formula in a constantly changing, evolving, and performance-based environment right. If you're trying to do that, I wish you the best of luck. If you are enjoying the podcast, please subscribe and follow us on social media. We have profiles on Instagram and Twitter.